explicitly. And but I can find that.
I'll ask you a few questions. Was it an in vitro or in vivo study?
It was, I think, an in vitro, I believe.
And were the doses of thimerosal equivalent to the doses that are contained in thimerosal-containing vaccines?
I don't remember specifically what the doses were, but regarding the dosage question, which I think I kind of went on a tangent, I didn't answer your question. The dosage is not the biggest issue when it comes to mercury, in the sense that if you look at all children that are vaccinated, if everyone receives the same dose of methylmercury, or ethylmercury for that matter, not every child will be affected. Instead, what most of the researchers have focused their attention on is the ability to excrete mercury from the body. I think most people tolerate thimerosal, not that it's necessarily safe, but people have had mechanisms in place with their body to excrete the thimerosal, excrete the ethylmercury. However, if you're genetically predisposed to not eliminate the ethylmercury, even if the dose is relatively small, you may have problems. So in other words, we're dealing with a sensitivity issue. There's a recent study that came out just this year measuring mercury in baby teeth, and that was a good indicator of increased body burden of thimerosal in the body. I think Bradstreet did a study where he looked at over 200 kids with autism. He compared them with a control to see if, to look at how they're excreting the mercury, and found that the control, they were able to excrete the thimerosal, or the mercury, I should say, but not the autism group. Amy Holmes has done a study where she looked at first baby hairs, where it was found that children with autism were not able to excrete mercury, or they were not able to eliminate it from their body. And if you have a high body burden of ethylmercury, then it goes to the brain and other tissues and can cause damage. So I think it's very important to know that we're really dealing with an underlying problem of elimination. Talking about biological plausibility, we do have other models. For example, one neurological problem where a heavy metal is not excreted is Wilson's disease. Wilson's disease is a condition where some individuals are not able to excrete copper. The copper goes to the brain, the retina, other conditions, and you have problems.
And that genetic condition has been identified, correct? We know the gene that causes Wilson's disease.
Yes, we know the gene that causes Wilson's disease.
And we can't identify the genetic causation of somebody's inability to excrete or not excrete mercury. There's been no identified genetic disorders.
Well,
is that correct?
Since 2003, fortunately, we've been able to, not me, but other scientists, to come up with to complete the Human Genome Project. And there's a lot of research underway to understand underlying mechanisms. What I think will happen in the future is we'll never, ever, I can make that statement with confidence, we'll never find a or an autistic gene. We'll never do that. But what we will find in the future, or geneticists, is we'll find groups of genes and susceptibility factors that may account for different traits. For example, we may identify in the future particular genetic mutations or problems that interfere with the ability to excrete certain metals, or other things of that nature.
But as of right now, that's pure speculation.
But what's the speculation?
That there is a genetically susceptible class of children that cannot excrete mercury.
No, that's not speculation at all. There have been several studies that have compared children with autism versus children without autism, and it's been shown that the children with autism are not able to excrete the mercury, meaning that they have a greater body burden than those who do not have autism and are able to excrete the mercury.
And
so that part's not speculative.
What are those studies again?
I mentioned Bradstreet did a study where he looked at over 200 children.
Do you know where that was published?
It was a few years ago. I don't remember the specific date.
And that was his hair study. Is that correct?
No, the hair study was yet another study. Amy Holmes did a study. That was also a few years ago. And don't quote me on the date, 2002, 2001, or something like that. Amy Holmes in Louisiana did a study where she looked at baby hairs. Now, this was an interesting study because she really did not anticipate the findings. She thought that the group of children with autism would probably have a lot of mercury excretion, but what she found was just the opposite. Kids with autism had a very low amount of mercury in their hair compared to other children with autism. And so with the help of Boyd Haley, I think, who's a toxicologist, they were able to work out the mechanism and show that there's a problem with excretion. There's a study, and I apologize, I forget the name, but we can give it to you. I have it here, of a study that came out just this year in 2007 looking at increased mercury in the teeth of children with autism, again showing this increased body burden concept.
That study was the baby teeth of autistic children, is that correct?
Yes, I don't remember their age. I don't think they were young like the children in Amy Holmes' group.
Are teeth excretory organs? I mean, do people excrete mercury through their teeth normally?
I don't know too much about dental physiology in that sense, but it appears that the teeth is one way of measuring body burden of anything. In fact, in that study, they looked not only at mercury, but they looked at lead, and I think they looked at cadmium. They specifically found that if you looked at both groups, there was not a problem with lead, there was not a problem with cadmium, I think, but there was a problem with mercury. So that was good, you know, selective proof of body burden. So that has been looked at in a variety of ways, teeth, hair, and other methods. And that just gives credence to the fact that we're not looking at a dosage problem. If you're able to eliminate, regardless of the dose, I shouldn't say regardless, if it's an extremely high dose, you will be toxic, but if it's a reasonable dose, then you may be able to tolerate the effects, the toxic effects. But if you don't have the underlying genetic predisposition to clear the toxin from your body, then you'll have problems. And I think that's what all of the studies that I have reviewed show, that we're dealing with a problem, genetically based susceptibility to clear mercury from the body, not necessarily a toxin. And I can, if I may.
I was just going to say, for the record, I believe the article to which you're referring is the 2007 Adams.
Yes, that's it.
Okay.
Adams, yes.
Exhibit, petitioner's exhibit 45.
If I just might add that I think between 1850 and 1950, there was a disorder called Pink's disease, which baffled the medical community for about 100 years. This was a condition where children would just become very irritable for no apparent reason. They would cry for long hours. They had acridemia. The extremities turned red and so forth. And no one could figure out what happened with these kids until, I think it was in the 1950s or so, they discovered that they were using teething lotions and other things that contained mercury that was getting in the system, and that was causing various problems, hypersensitivity and other types of things. Now, some people have said that Pink's disease is synonymous with autism. This is one area I do not quite agree, because the symptoms, if you look at Pink's disease, there's some autistic characteristics with Pink's disease, but I don't think it matches up 100%. But I use that example just to say that many kids were using the same teething lotions, same concentration, same dose, but only some came down with this Pink's disease, suggesting that, again, we're not dealing with a dose issue, but we're likely dealing with the genetically based underlying susceptibility to clear the toxin.
In Pink's disease, the teething powder was administered by parents as needed. Is that correct? To the gums of the children?
I believe so.
Then how can you conclude that all the doses that the children received were the same?
I don't mean to conclude or to say that they were the same, but if you look at an entire population, only some of the children came down with, you know, with Pink's disease. But that is a valid point. We don't know exactly how much. I don't think any study was done to look at, you know, how much they were given. But the point I was trying to make is, you know, it's likely that some people came down with the disease because of the conscience. In other words, not everyone that used it. You might have a family where, you know, let's say you had twins, for example, this part is speculation. You know, one, you know, someone might come down with it and someone else, you know. But with vaccines, that is not the case because we know exactly how much mercury everyone is getting, and we know that some people are susceptible, others are not.
How do we know that some people are susceptible and some people are not?
How do we know that some people are susceptible to mercury toxicity?
Yes, and some people are not.
I'm using that based on studies where, you know, children are compared that have an inability to clear mercury versus individuals who are able to clear it very well, and they, the ones that are able to clear it do not have symptoms. Going back to Amy Holmes' group, not only did she find that individuals who were able to, who had a low hair mercury level, not only did she find that these children were autistic, she was able to stratify, that is, those with a lower level, those that were not excreting things at all, were more severely affected. So I think what I'm trying to emphasize is the fact that dose, I don't think, is the biggest player. What is a susceptibility to clear toxins.
What is the Bradstreet study that you rely on?
I don't remember the year, but it's referenced in the Cedillo case. It was, I think, a few years ago. He looked at 260 children or so, and he compared them with a control. The control was smaller. And he tried to measure, I believe, the excretion of mercury in children with autism versus children without autism, and found he found that, I think, that the children with autism had a higher body burden than the group that did not.
What did he study? It wasn't the hair. Was it urine? Was it feces? What did he study?
I think he might have done urine. Now, I'm not sure which direction this question is going, but if I may just kind of elaborate a little bit, there have been other studies. I think Fumbone did a study, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing his name well, where he looked at blood levels of mercury and concluded, well, you know, there are no changes with autism and non-autistic children. If one is going to do a study, it has to be done correctly. If someone's exposed to mercury, that mercury does not stay in the bloodstream for very long. So if you want to look at body burden, you have to do a chelation challenge, which means that you give a chelator, you check the urine a few hours, and then you can measure if something's coming up.
And to do a chelation study, don't you need both pre-chelation studies, pre-chelation levels, and post-chelation levels?
That's exactly the way I would do a study. Yes.
And did Dr. Bradstreet do his study with pre-chelation levels?
I don't remember exactly how he did his study, but, you know, I know Dr. Bradstreet is very well aware of pre- and post-chelation issues, so it wouldn't surprise me a bit if he conducted a study the proper way.
And if he did not obtain pre-chelation levels, mm-hmm. would you still rely on that study to show that there, as a
if
subset of
rely,
children, mm-hmm. yes, who cannot excrete mercury?
I think that there would still be an indication that there's something wrong if you don't do a pre-chelation and that you do a chelation challenge and that one group is excreting a lot of mercury in a group is not, I think that already shows something. But in terms of pre- and post-chelation, that would be a, you know, that's something else that could be done as well. But I think that even without doing the pre-chelation, just showing that one group has heavy metals that you're able to prove through chelation versus a group that you give a chelator, the same chelator, the same dose, they're not excreting these, the mercury. You can conclude that there's a difference that should be meaningful. I think the purpose of the study was to show through a laboratory test that children with autism have a higher body burden of mercury. And the mechanism to explain that is inability to spontaneously excrete mercury.
How else can you get mercury in your body?
Which type of mercury are you talking about?
Methylmercury.
Methylmercury could be obtained through a lot of different sources. Fish, the environment, just, I think all of us are exposed to mercury in one way or another. So it's...
And did Dr. Bradstreet's chelation study differentiate between ethylmercury and methylmercury found in the urine?
I don't recall.
Did Dr. Bradstreet's study take into account dietary concerns?
Such as?
Fish consumption.
I don't know.
Would that make a difference to you in the reliability of that study, that it's due to thimerosal-containing vaccines, the chelation levels?
Not really, in the sense that assuming, well, the research that I have found is that the fish that we consume are regulated. There are guidelines. The amount of mercury from fish, unless you eat a lot of shark and some other types of fish, the smaller fish are fairly safe based on the normal American consumption of fish, which is not extremely high. So, generally speaking, unless you had someone who was eating a lot of shark and someone who had no exposure to fish at all, that might potentially play a role, potentially.
Do you know how much mercury there is in a can of tuna fish?
I don't know, but I think that that's, highly variable. Tuna is a bigger fish. I know there are certain types of tunas that contain a lot of mercury, but the last reports that I saw is that the average can of tuna with the regular consumption that most Americans would use would not, be necessarily give a problem. But I can't tell you the numbers.
But we don't know whether Dr. Bradstreet did take a dietary profile of any of these children to know their fish consumption, what type of fish consumption.
Yes, I don't know.
You agree that methylmercury and ethylmercury are different forms?
Yes, I agree that they're two different organic mercurial compounds.
And would you agree that they have different toxicological properties?
Yes, I think we still need to study them in more detail, but as I mentioned earlier, it seems that when ethylmercury goes to the brain, it converts to inorganic mercury is 7 times faster than methylmercury. So we know that there are differences.
What is the basis for that statement?
You mean, how did they do the study?
No, what is the basis for your statement that ethylmercury converts into inorganic mercury 7 times
faster?
There
was one study that looked at ethylmercury in comparison to methylmercury, and that's the conclusion based on the study, based on their methodology. That's what they were able to report. I'm not a toxicologist, so I cannot comment on the intricacies of that particular study. But
can you name that study?
I don't remember the author, but I'd be happy to make sure that this is provided to the court for the records.
Do you know how long it takes for ethylmercury to clear the bloodstream?
I'm not sure exactly how long.
Do you know how long it takes for methylmercury to clear the bloodstream?
I think methylmercury can clear the bloodstream in, I've seen some reports that say weeks. I've seen some that say a little bit sooner. But it does, maybe a few weeks. And that's an important consideration, because if you're going to assess mercury levels in someone who's been exposed several months ago, that may skew your study results.
You talked about the studies at Minamata and Seychelles and Faroes, I think in your testimony today and also in your report. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Were those prenatal or postnatal exposures at Minamata?
My understanding from the studies is that they were mostly prenatal, is my understanding.
Of methylmercury,
correct? Of methylmercury, that's correct.
Maternal consumption of fish, is that correct?
Yes, contaminated maternal consumption of fish.
And how does that study compare to the dose of thimerosal that children receive postnatally in thimerosal-containing vaccines?
First of all, that study did look at methylmercury, not ethylmercury, and they were looking at prenatal exposures. The children that were affected had a different type of problem. A lot of them had cerebral palsy type of picture. I use that example just to suggest that organic mercury in general, and specifically methylmercury, does affect the developing brain. That's the starting point. We talked about biological plausibility. It is biologically plausible based on this model that organic mercury in the developing brain is toxic, neurotoxic. At the same time, I think these studies show that the adults, as far as I recall from the study, were not affected as the children were, which suggests that if you have a young child who's having rapid brain development, which is the case for young infants, that they're particularly susceptible to toxins in general. I think the Faroe Islands, there was a differentiation between the Faroe Islands and Seychelles, where I think there were more problems in the Faroe Islands, even though superficially they were both consuming, you know, contaminated fish, but they found that there were other environmental factors such as PCBs and other toxins involved in the children with in the Faroe Islands. The other thing that was very interesting is the idea of pulsing. Instead of a one big bolus, they were getting these exposures, you know, intermittently. So I use this as a model, basically, to strongly suggest, based on epidemiologic studies, that organic mercury is toxic to the neurodevelopmental brain. I'm not using that study to say that this study shows that thimerosal causes autism. No, I'm saying that these studies point us to the direction of looking at environmental factors. That's why I strongly believe that environmental factors play a role in autism, other neurodevelopmental problems, as demonstrated by these cases.
Were those studies dose related? Do we know the dose? Minimata.
Which one? Minimata in Japan?
Do we know the dose of methylmercury?
I don't know if we have the dose. You're talking about Minimata. You're not talking about the Faroe Island and Seychelles.
We'll go there first. Let's start with Minimata.
Yes.
They're different.
Yes. I don't recall the dose. I'm not saying they didn't study the dose, but I don't recall that detail. All I know is that with the Minimata disease, you know, many individuals were affected. Older individuals, not children, in fact, with Minimata disease, and also Iraq, where grain was contaminated with methylmercury. This is what led the U.S. to go and look at what's happening with the Faroe Islands and Seychelles. So one group of epidemiologic problems led to further investigation. And I think that's the way science works. We look at all of the data, what I would call the natural history of things, and we try to apply what we know from nature, from past experiences, to what we see happening right now.
In the Seychelles and Faroe Islands, let's start with the Seychelles Islands. What was the consumption of fish in the Seychelles Islands?
You mean what type of fish?
What type of fish?
I don't recall.
What were the resulting neurological deficits that resulted from the prenatal exposure of fish consumption in the Seychelles?
I think there was a range of problems ranging from neurodevelopmental to motor problems, cerebral palsy type pictures. I think there was a range of neurological impairment, not just one particular problem. Learning deficits, things like that.
Cerebral palsy?
Yes, cerebral palsy picture. In other words, cerebral palsy is a condition where there is an abnormality in your muscle tone. So children with cerebral palsy can either be spastic, where they're very tight, or they can be very floppy. And there's an arrest, usually, or a problem with their motor development. And of course, kids with cerebral palsy may have seizures. Some have mental retardation, though not all of them. So that was also one of the several neurological complications seen there.
Was autism, is there an increase in autism in the Seychelles as a result of the methylmercury?
In the studies I reviewed, I don't, at least in the articles I looked at, I didn't see autism. What I saw was a range of neurodevelopmental and motor problems. Now, that does not mean that there was not autism, because I doubt very much that in the island there were people who were very aware of autism and knew what to check I think that there has been better recognition of autism over the years. So, in fact, that's why some people believe that, I'm one of them, believe that better diagnostic or better awareness has led to better recognition of autism. So I believe that if there were children with autism, and there's a possibility that they were, that investigators probably were either not aware of autism and therefore did not ascertain whether that was present.
That's just speculation on your part, however, correct?
Pure speculation, yes.
Faroe Islands, do you know the consumption of fish?
I don't know the type of fish, but what I do know with the Faroe Islands is that studies showed there was more involvement of neurological impairment than in the Seychelles Islands. And I think that that led to some comparative studies to see, the cerebral palsy type picture, I think a lot of these things apply to the Faroe Islands. With the Faroe Islands, what was found is that a lot of the children had more complications than the Seychelles Islands, at least that was statistically significant epidemiologically. And I thought that was important too, because, you know, on the surface they're both exposed to similar types of toxins, but later it was found that there was a different type of exposure in terms of more toxicities in the Faroe Islands, not just the thimerosal, but according to what I read, PCBs and other toxins. And again, I want to emphasize, that's why I talk of contributing factors. There may be other things out there in the environment that we do not yet know of, but hopefully in the future we'll have better understanding of all of the various contributing factors to autism, both genetic and environmental.
Now, the Faroe Islands, you said thimerosal or methylmercury?
If I said thimerosal, I meant methylmercury.
Okay. And then what was the other possible?
PCBs.
Do you know if there's an increase in the diagnosis or incidence of autism in the Faroe Islands?
I don't know, but the same thing that I said about the Seychelles Islands would definitely apply to the Faroe Islands.
You state on page 15 of your report, although it's the last paragraph, although signs of acute mercury toxicity are different from those of autism, it is very reasonable that ethyl mercury toxicity in chronic low doses with environmental triggers can contribute to the development of autism.
Yes.
Could you please define chronic low dose?
What I meant when I was writing this particular paragraph, chronic low dose, is instead of a one-time large bolus, whether by mouth or intravenously, I was trying to say a repetitive dosing pattern. For example, children who are vaccinated at 2, 4, 6 months, a year, and so forth, if we're looking at mercury, they're exposed in pulses, as opposed to someone who has a large bolus of intravenous ethyl mercury, or methylmercury for that matter, I suspect, and I think these epidemiologic studies would also support that the changes would be very different. So that's exactly what I meant to say.
So your definition of chronic is every few months over the course of a specific time period.
And there's no specificity. I was just trying to say recurrent doses, whether it's, you know, a month, 3 months, but just recurrent doses as opposed to a big, large dose. A good example is lead. I've taken care of kids with acute lead toxicity. If you have a very high level of lead exposure, that may land you to the ICU with coma, seizures, and other types of problems. And by the way, you would need chelation with EDTA. But if you're exposed to lead, for example, if you live in a very old house and you're exposed to lead in a smaller level but in a more chronic fashion, you may have other symptoms such as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. There may be changes in your blood in terms of small microcytic cells. And So you may have a different set of clinical presentations.
So in that paragraph, when you refer to chronic low doses, you just mean the normal vaccination schedule the children undergo.
That would be one example. I wasn't just referring to that, but that would be one example of a repetitive small dose toxin.
Chronic. You say chronic in your report.
But yes.
What do you mean by low dose?
Low is not very specific, but what I mean is a dose that in most healthy individuals should not cause signs of acute toxicity. Just in that context, I used dose. I did not include a specific value because the only point I was trying to make is just a dose that's low enough to be considered tolerable to most people. Did I answer your question?
And that would be, so chronic low doses is just simply saying the vaccines that children receive in the normal course of proper medical care.
No, that's, you can infer that, but all I was trying to say, or what I was intending to say when I was writing this, is that, if you have a repetitive dose that's low, you can have symptoms. I was, in my mind, contrasting that with a situation where instead of having several doses over a period of time, you just have one large bolus. And I think that question is pertinent to, other conditions that have been attributed to autism with methylmercury presenting different ways. I think that if a person has a very high exposure to mercury, and that they have verifiable mercury toxicity, depending on how the mercury is given, they may have a totally different set of symptoms. For example, if you give a very high dose of mercury, let's say methylmercury, or even ethyl mercury, as one of my articles point or show, you may have renal shutdown, you may have renal failure. You may not necessarily have that if you have a small dose given in small repetitive dosages.
So dose is important. Would you agree?
If
dose is important?
It's important in the sense that it can dictate the way certain symptoms manifest. In that sense, low one-time dose toxicity versus small recurrent dose. But it's not important in this sense, or as important in the sense of stating that in order to have certain symptoms, you have to have a particular dose, because that varies depending on the individual. If an individual has a very good ability to clear certain toxins, for example, let's say they have a healthy set of enzymes we call metallothionine, which is an enzyme that's responsible for clearing or detoxifying heavy metals, then that person may tolerate a higher dose of mercury versus someone who's exposed to just a low dose of mercury, but because the particular enzyme whose job it is to rid the mercury is not functioning properly, that individual with a relatively small dose may run into problems or may develop symptoms.
Is it not also true, Dr. Corbier, that dose is important? When you refer to chronic low dose, you say you didn't know what that was, but it was the level at which a dose would be acceptable or that most people could survive.
Right, yes.
Could
tolerate, yes.
So dosage is also important.
Yes. For that purpose, absolutely. Let's put it this way. Another way to rephrase what I'm trying to say is, I don't think that the thimerosal that children receive and those that do not have symptoms, I don't think it's because necessarily that level is safe, but I think that at that level, most people's immune system, most people have a level of, how should I say, they have enzymes that are competent enough to, at that level, detoxify the particular chemical. So another way to put this yet is if we were to give higher and higher doses, there would be more and more people that would show vulnerabilities to the thimerosal or any other agent for that matter. So it's in that sense that I think. I don't know if I'm making sense, but I have one thing in mind, but I don't know if I'm expressing it. Did I You understand.
Is the inability to excrete mercury a recognized condition in the general medical community?
What do you mean by general medical community? What was your definition of general medical
community? Is there a diagnostic code for it?
I believe that would go under a toxicological code. I can't tell you what that code is.
But there is a specific code for an inability to excrete mercury.
I don't know that the code would just apply to mercury. It might, or it might just be a code dealing with heavy metal problems in general.
If I asked a medical toxicologist if he recognized the condition of a person's inability to excrete mercury, I think he would recognize that condition.
I've spoken to several and know of several very well qualified professors in toxicology that would say yes. I also know others that would say no, but in medicine, controversies occur all the time.
Can you explain to me how an inability to excrete mercury causes autism?
You have to basically see what happens if you don't excrete mercury. The first thing that has been shown is if you do not excrete mercury, that mercury will leave the blood system. So if you're exposed, it'll first go to the blood system. And as we said earlier, after a few weeks or so, that mercury will travel and will go to different tissues, including the brain. That's an established fact. We know that mercury is neurotoxic. That, I think, is very well established. And we also know that several studies, which I mentioned before, have shown that children with autism, as compared to children who do not have autism, have demonstrated inability to get rid of the mercury. If they're not ridding the body of mercury naturally, that is, on their own, then that mercury is in the body, and I don't think there's most people would say that mercury is not safe. It's one of the, most remarkable toxins known to man. So if you're exposed to mercury, if you're not excreting it, it's going to different tissues, such as the brain. If we know that it's neurotoxic, and if we know that children with autism are shown through several studies to have a higher burden of mercury, then that's good evidence to suggest that mercury toxicity is linked to autism. I say linked because I'm not suggesting that that's the only factor present. If a child with autism is exposed to mercury and that child has the ability to properly excrete mercury, I don't think the mercury will necessarily contribute to that particular child's autism. If, on the other hand, it is a child with autism that has demonstrated inability to clear the body of mercury, then I think that's good clinical evidence, better than some other evidence that we use all the time in medicine to suggest that connection.
After thimerosal is injected into the body, what happens to that thimerosal?
The thimerosal will it'll stay in the bloodstream for a period of time. And then what will happen to the thimerosal is it will go to different tissues. And it's been shown that thimerosal can cross the blood-brain barrier. So one of the places that the mercury will end up in the thimerosal is the brain. I believe other organs, it may also go to other organs, but as far as our discussion, the brain is a main concern.
What other organs does the mercury, does the thimerosal?
I saw some studies that showed that it can go to the kidneys, for instance.
Do you know what percentage of the mercury goes to the kidneys?
I don't know what percentage, but I can tell you that it's interesting that many children with autism have a specific metabolic condition called, it's a transsulfuration defect. It's a condition where, I'm trying to remember the name of the enzyme, it's sulfol, it's phenosulfotransferase deficiency, or PST for short. Phenosulfotransferase deficiency is a condition where there is an enzyme that's not allowing proper excretion of sulfates, or there's a problem with excretion of sulfates, and that involves the renal system. That's important because there are a lot of children that do not tolerate certain chemicals, including phenols, and that's attributed to this phenosulfotransferase connects to the renal system. And so the kidneys, I think, it can be a site of involvement in children with certain children with autism.
Where else does the thimerosal go to?
I think, can go to muscles, and I'm referring to a study that was done by Axton, where some individuals, this was a little bit different case, they received a big bolus of thimerosal, and a lot of them had necrosis of the buttocks. So I assume that you can have some, you know, local reaction from the thimerosal.
Do you know the dose in that study?
I don't know that the dose was identified because the thimerosal was actually a contaminant of chlorpheniclol, which is an antibiotic, and a lot of those studies were in Africa. And so they did not even know initially that the thimerosal was present until later, until kids started having problems. It was not just children, there were adults as well.
But you don't know whether dose was discussed in those papers?
I don't know, but I know they were able to identify the thimerosal, but I don't know what the dose is. I would suspect it's a higher dose than what would be found in vaccines.
You state that the ethyl mercury crosses the blood-brain barrier and goes to the brain.
Yeah.
The thimerosal. What percentage goes to the brain?
Versus other tissues?
Yes.
I don't think we know that, or at least I don't.
And what happens to the mercury once it goes to the brain?
Once the organic mercury goes to the brain, it is fairly rapidly converted to the inorganic form. The inorganic form then will bind to certain proteins in the brain very tightly, and then it will stay there and for prolonged periods of time. And that's according to a study.
How does mercury in the brain cause autism?
I don't know exactly how mercury in the brain causes autism, but because some studies that I have reviewed show loss of brain cells in particular areas, such as the temporal lobes, the limbic system, these are all areas where if you have any type of lesion, it does not have to be thimerosal, it could be an encephalitis or neurochemical change, you can then develop autistic symptoms. So I think it's very reasonable to say that because the thimerosal will affect certain parts of the brain that are known to be particular areas, that through neuropathologic studies, volumetric MRI studies, been shown to be associated with autism, that could be how it does. In other words, it's a question of, in that case, location, and not necessarily mechanism. Various impairments in the appropriate parts of the brain can be solved with autistic symptoms, and it doesn't matter if it's a virus, it doesn't matter if it's a toxin, it doesn't matter if it's trauma. Some people with trauma have developed autistic symptoms. So that would be my answer.
So is the inorganic mercury then in the temporal lobe? Where is the inorganic mercury stored?
Yeah.
All over?
In different areas, and the temporal lobe is one area. I believe the cerebellum is another area. The cerebellum has also been implicated in, or it's one location that's been implicated in autism, the Purkinje cells of the cerebellum. Through neuropathic studies, is one area that's involved. So that's one area where there's nerve cell damage due to thimerosal.
What studies are you relying on for that?
For which one?
Where the inorganic mercury goes in the brain.
I don't remember the authors, but I can get that to you. I reviewed quite a few studies with, and I can't remember all of the authors.
How does thimerosal or mercury cross? Are we? Does it thimerosal go to the brain, or the ethyl mercury that goes to the brain?
Well, I don't know what happens to the thiosalicylate, and I don't know if that's been looked at very carefully. The only study that I'm aware of that looked at thiosalicylate, which is also part of thimerosal, and ethyl mercury, what that study did was to specifically say that the thimerosal or the ethyl mercury component had an effect on the immune system, but not the thiosalicylate. I think that study was trying to look at the specific component that's toxic to the body. But that's all I know.
How does it cross the blood-brain barrier?
When you say how, and what do you mean by that?
The mechanism.
Well, I don't know exactly what the mechanism is. I don't think that's been studied. But I would assume that it's the same way that any toxin that crosses the brain would, that it would occur.
How does ethyl mercury convert into inorganic mercury?
Ethyl mercury converts by a process called methylation. Methylation is an organic compound where you have a carbon atom and three hydrogen molecules. So if you attach a methyl group to an organic mercury compound like ethyl mercury or methyl mercury, then that'll convert to an inorganic form. That's kind of interesting because some studies have shown that children with autism in general have a higher exposure to antibiotics. So they're on multiple antibiotics. That's a problem as well as far as mercury is concerned because in the gut we usually have a natural gut flora where we have friendly bacteria, so-called probiotics. And what these do is that they will methylate. They will convert the organic form to the inorganic form, and then what happens is that the inorganic mercury could leave the body very easily. If the gut flora is affected such that you wipe out the gut flora and instead you have a buildup of yeast, which several studies show that kids with autism have yeast, or if you have E. coli, then they do the reverse. So instead of having a methylation from the organic to the inorganic, they do not do this methylation, so you have a remnants of the methyl mercury, and that is allowed to absorb more quickly in the system, and that can cause problems. I mention that because it's important to look at the immune system, the gut, the brain. I think the more studies that are coming out, the more we're able to have a clear and clearer picture of what happens to children with autism from a biochemical standpoint, from a gastrointestinal standpoint, from an immunological standpoint, and from a neurological standpoint.
What studies show that thimerosal causes brain damage?
There is a study in Japan, and I don't remember the author, but he showed, I think that was one of the studies where they showed specific neuronal damage to brain cells with exposure to mercury. To thimerosal.
It was dose a factor?
I don't recall that detail.
Was
I don't
it
recall
in
that. I don't remember exactly how that study was conducted, but that was found. And then some, as I mentioned earlier, some other studies were able to find the specific location of methyl mercury.
Was the study in Japan an in vitro or in vivo study?
I believe it was an in vivo, but I'd have to check.
And I just want to go to the paragraph on page 15, the second paragraph from the bottom. A statement by the U.S. Public Health Service, Department of Health and Human Services, that paragraph?
Yes, I see.
Has the Department of Health and Human Services ever stated that there is evidence that thimerosal-containing vaccines cause autism?
I don't think I've seen that statement, but this statement basically suggests that there was enough concern that something had to be done. So I assume, and this is just an assumption, that with all of the information that they had at hand at that time, there was enough concern to request that Thimerosal be removed urgently. I don't think if there was no concern whatsoever that they would have made that comment. I am aware that some of the people that were involved here were probably aware that not adequate studies or not enough studies were done when Thimerosal was added to vaccines as an adjuvant. So I think with that and, you know, research showing that there are problems, that that was enough to suggest that Thimerosal be removed, and I think that's that should be applauded.
Hasn't the American Academy of Pediatrics specifically stated that Thimerosal containing vaccines pose no risk, increased risk of autism?
If they may have, but that would contradict their position in this statement. So.
Has the EPA ever stated that Thimerosal that's contained in Thimerosal-containing vaccines causes autism?
I don't think they were that specific, no.
Is it your opinion that Yates has persistent measles virus in his gut, which either caused or contributed to his autism?
In his gut. I think it's more likely than not that that's the case. I can't prove it right now because I don't, labs were not done to prove it, but he does have similar findings, the lymphonodular hyperplasia, the colitis, that children who have been shown to have the persistent measles virus were noted to have this persistent virus. So I'm kind of inferring based on that, that that's a likely explanation.
Is it your opinion that Yates has autistic enterocolitis?
Autistic enterocolitis is a term that Dr. Wakefield introduced to the medical community. And I think what Dr. Wakefield was saying with that term is that in the subset of children that he looked at that had gastrointestinal problems, lymphonodular hyperplasia, and autism, that they had this new entity that he described as enterocolitis, autistic enterocolitis. In the sense that Yates had the lymphonodular hyperplasia, and or has lymphonodular hyperplasia and autism, then that term would be applicable, yes.
Could you please describe any advanced training you've had in the specialty of pediatric immunology?
What do you mean by specialized training? You mean like a fellowship?
Yes.
No, I specialize in child neurology.
And issues relating to immunology, would you then to defer to the opinion of a board-certified pediatric immunologist?
Yes, and I think in my initial visit, we talked to Yates about needing to do further immunological workup with an immunologist, and I meant by that board-certified immunologist. In my approach to autism or any neurological problem, I look at it as a team effort. I'm trained in the field of neurology, try to keep up as best as I can with the other fields, but we do not hesitate to enlist the help of other specialists in other areas to make sure we have a comprehensive approach for the benefit of the patient.
If there were no evidence of persistent measles virus in Yates' gut, if the tissue samples came back negative, would you still assume that the MMR vaccine played a role in his development of autism?
If that were done and there was no persistent measles, that would lessen my current position. But I would have to, before I, you know, made a definitive opinion, I would have to look at other mechanisms such as autoimmunity. Yates did have an immunologic workup, but I don't think that included autoantibodies. So that would have to be included as well.
How certain would you be of the MMR contributing to the development of autism without the finding of persistent measles virus? Would it still be more likely than not?
Well, I would say yes. It would be less, but still, I mean, unless I can come up with an alternative explanation, You have a child who's doing well, who regresses after a very specific event. I would use the same approach for medications. If I start someone on a new medication such as Dilantin, and all of a sudden that individual starts having neutropenia or low blood count or some other symptoms or ataxia, for example, yes, it could be coincidence, but I would say, you know, unless I could find an alternative explanation, the drug I recently started that caused a change in a patient likely is the playing a main role or contributing factor.
You state that you're not arguing that MMR causes autism. It's on page 14 of your report, but can be one along with several other environmental triggers.
Yes.
And what I want to discuss next are, what are the environmental triggers that you're talking about, environmental factors?
One would be thimerosal. Another would be, there are a number of viruses that have been implicated in autism. Certain herpes viruses, we mentioned herpes encephalitis, you documented cases by not only the ones listed here, but Dr. DeLong. Basically there are other causes or other contributing factors in the environment. Rubella, you know, we talk a lot about measles, but rubella has been implicated, certain medications, certain anticonvulsants. So although our knowledge isn't complete at this point, there are various environmental triggers that I think are widely accepted by many individuals as contributing to autism.
Is the list that you just recited an exhaustive list?
Not at all. I just mentioned the ones that, you know, most people, you know, talk about or reported in the literature, but there's a growing number of environmental factors that are implicated in autism. And the ones I mentioned are pretty much accepted across the board.
Are there any other ones that you can think of?
Some people have looked at environmental toxins from the emissions from certain factories. For example, there was a epidemiologic study at Brick Township in New Jersey where they found that there was a very big cluster of children with autism. And they found that not too far from where these families were staying, there was a factory. I don't remember the specific factory, but there was a very, very high concentration of children in that particular township in New Jersey. That could not really be explained readily by just genetics alone. So that particular set of environmental factors or these emissions from the factories were implicated. I do believe personally that there are a lot of toxins in the environment that can play a role, not only with autism, but with the growing number of children we see with asthma, allergies, and also neurodevelopmental problems.
With all of these environmental toxins, how do you identify the two that you're speaking of today, thimerosal-containing vaccines and MMR, as being the more likely causes of the development of autism?
That's an excellent question. I go by what we have, the evidence that we have. We know that these children are exposed to thimerosal. We know it's toxic, or MMR for that matter. I always leave a room for other agents, other environmental triggers being present. I don't know what they are yet. I would not be surprised if in the future a growing number of environmental factors are discovered. And that's why I almost insist on saying contributing factor, because there may be many. There may be many.
If there are many, do you know the percentage then, let's say, thimerosal-containing vaccines play amongst all of these contributing environmental factors?
I don't know that answer, and I don't know if anyone does.
Could the exposure of these other environmental triggers that you've spoken of, and I believe you say there are probably some out there that we don't even know about, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Could these other environmental triggers, in your opinion, cause the development of autism without exposure to either measles or thimerosal-containing vaccines?
Are you saying if a child is not vaccinated with, say, MMR or thimerosal, could that child with those exposures develop autism? Is that your question?
Would you attribute it to other than toxological or environmental exposures?
I think that there are various different types of toxins that can play a role. This is purely, we don't know what these are, but I believe that any neurotoxic agent that the developing brain is exposed to in the right individual meaning someone that has the right genetic predisposition, can result not only in the development of autism, but it could also contribute to other conditions, neurological or non-neurological.
Can the exposure of thimerosal and thimerosal-containing vaccines without the other environmental factors cause a child to develop autism?
I believe, based on the studies that I have seen, that the best I could say is it's possible. The problem is, you know, many children that receive DTP and other vaccines containing thimerosal also receive MMR. There are other environmental triggers that are present. So at least at this time, it's a little hard to separate or distinguish each different factor.
And I'll ask the same question with MMR. Can exposure to MMR without the other environmental factors cause a child to develop autism?
I think it's likely, but again, I think that I don't know how many studies, I don't think I've seen some that have isolated MMR as an only environmental factor. I don't think that we're anywhere near the level of this technique necessary to isolate one particular environmental factor compared to another. And I would say the same applies to almost any aspect of medicine.
In your report, you rely on two in vitro studies with high doses of thimerosal to demonstrate that thimerosal can cause oxidative stress and or the depletion of glutathione. Yeah. Are there any in vivo studies that support this hypothesis?
I believe Dr. James has done a lot of work, which I believe is in vivo, but I'd have to double check.
Do the in vivo studies that you refer to show similar results with doses of thimerosal that are contained in thimerosal-containing vaccines?
I believe so, but I'm not sure that the doses are exactly similar.
And I am almost done, so. You state in your report that you're the recipient of the ROC Award.
Yeah.
What is the ROC Award?
When I did my training as an adult neurology person in training at the University of Cincinnati, I distinguished myself academically in terms of my performance. So my program director gave me an award called the ROC Award that he named after me for my academic performance in my adult year of neurology training.
Who is your program director?
His name is John Quinlan.
Is that an award that's recognized by the University of Cincinnati Medical School?
I don't know how to answer that question. I don't know that an award like that had been given before.
Has it been given since?
What's that?
Has it been given since?
I've not asked that question to Dr. Quinlan. I have asked him to give me letters of recommendation when I needed a letter, but I did not discuss that particular finding. Actually, that's not too important to me, so I don't know. Or, you know, having that continue is what I'm saying is not too relevant to me.
So the ROC Award was just something that was bestowed upon you by your program director?
It was an award that was created and that was named after me. I was the first recipient for that award and it carried my name.
And you may have also been the last recipient of that award, is that correct?
That I don't know. I have not tried to find out.
And he was, Dr. Quinlan was the worked in the adult neurology section?
Yes. When you train as a child neurologist, you do a full year of adult neurology, and then you do pediatric training, and then you do a year of adult neurology, followed by 2 years of child neurology. My year of adult neurology was done at the University of Cincinnati, and John Quinlan was the program director there.
And if I told you that we contacted the adult neurology department at the University of Cincinnati Medical School and they had not heard of that award, would that surprise you?
I would say that you probably did not talk to John Quinlan.
You also state in your expert report that you did extra training at the Mayo Clinic and at Johns Hopkins University?
That is correct.
What extra training did you do at Johns Hopkins University?
I basically applied. I contacted them and told them that I wanted to further my training. I had already, I was in a program where I had a complete medical training, but I wanted to do some further training in what I considered, very recognized institution. So I decided to go various places. The first place was University of Michigan. The next was Johns Hopkins, and then I went to the Mayo Clinic.
And you were
It was general. Well, at the Mayo Clinic, I did adult neurology, further adult neurology training. And at Johns Hopkins, it was further pediatric neurology training, if that answers your question.
And the further training, it was a year-long program that you entered?
A month at each place, a month.
A month at Johns Hopkins and a month
at the Mayo.
At the Mayo Clinic.
That's correct.
On page 2 of your report, you make the statement that given the discovery that immune mechanisms are implicated in autism, what studies are you referring to that immune mechanisms are implicated in autism?
I'm sorry, where are you?
I'm sorry, it's on page 2 of your report.
Okay, well, which paragraph? Second sentence. Full given. Oh, yes, okay, I see. Yes. What is the question then?
What studies do you rely on for your statement that immune mechanisms, there's a discovery that immune mechanisms...
There are actually several studies. There's Dr. Zimmerman at Johns Hopkins. There's Dr. Ashwood. There's Dr. Gupta. There's Dr. Singh. And these are just some of the researchers that have done a lot of work in the immunology of autism, but I'm sure there are several more.
Singh is the last
Zimmerman.
One?
Zimmerman.
No, you said Dr. Zimmerman.
Singh. I think that's, I believe it's S-I-N-G-H. And Dr. Ashwood is one of the articles that we have listed.
And Dr. Zimmerman, he's a pediatric neurologist?
That is correct.
He's not an immunologist?
No, he's a neurologist, but he has studied the immunology of autism.
Do you consider him an authority on the issue?
In the issue of the immunological aspects?
Yes.
I respect Dr. Zimmerman, and I consider him, yes, and one of the authorities.
You state in your opinion that Yates suffered from a compromised immune system.
Yeah, I believe that he shows clinical signs of an immunological disturbance, yes.
And what is the basis for that opinion?
Being sick all of the time.
It's the number of upper respiratory infections?
Upper respiratory infections, yeast infections, swollen lymphadenopathy or swollen lymph nodes that persist. I don't think I'd be that concerned if he was periodically sick. But a child who is, quote, sick all the time, I think, based on my experience, is significant clinically.
How many upper respiratory infections did Yates have that lead you to this conclusion that he had a compromised immune system?
Let me turn to my list. I list the different times on page 4 under immunologic profile that he was, at least that I could find, that he went to the pediatrician for treatment. So I base my report in part in this on these visits, but the sense that I get in talking to the parents is that he was not brought in every single time. We saw a report yesterday of Yates, for example, you know, having a screaming fit, and I don't think he necessarily went to the doctor for that right away. I think there are many cases where parents try not to go to the doctor if they don't have to. Sometimes they will, but a child can be sick and stay at home or try home remedies. Several studies show that many individuals, you know, have infections that they try to handle themselves. So if you look at all the infections, both the ones that are listed by the pediatricians and others, and the report that I heard that he was sick all the time, that is the basis for my saying that his immunologic system was impaired. Again, I would make a distinction between impairment and immunodeficiency. If you have classic immunodeficiency, that should show up on some of the, in most cases, in some of the immunological workup that the immunologist did. But that does not rule out an impairment of the immune system any more than, as I mentioned earlier, that a normal imaging, he's had normal CAT scan, EEG, and other testing, that would rule out the neurological problem. Also, I might add that not all of the immunological tests were done. There are a lot of other neurological tests that could have been a little bit more, I don't want to say pertinent in a way to minimize what was done, but that could have provided some more useful information.
How many episodes of thrush was, or candidus, was Yates actually diagnosed with?
Let me count on page 4. He had one on March 7th. On January 17th, he had thrush with possible yeast involvement of the skin and hand. And I put in quotation the actual mark or the actual statement of the pediatrician. On January 7th, I think that would be the third episode. There's mention of that, or that he had had thrush on May 4th, that he had previously had thrush. On May 5th, there's that mentioned as well. So what's that? I don't know, 5, 4, 5, 6, something. Whatever's listed in my report is what I was able to see from the medical records reported as thrush.
Did an examining pediatrician ever diagnose Yates with chronic swollen lymph nodes on examination?
I read a note from his pediatrician, I think Dr. Carlton Hayes, that from what I read from that note, or from what I gathered from that note, he was, it seemed, concerned enough to investigate that possibility that he was referred to an immunologist. As far as I can remember.
For chronic lymph nodes?
For evaluation of the immune system.
Okay, did Dr. Hayes ever diagnose Yates with chronic?
With a chronic problem. I don't recall. I don't recall.
So that comes from the parent. As far as you know, that your statement that he had chronic swollen lymph nodes comes from statements of the parents.
The pediatric visits, what they would ask the parents to do is to list symptoms. And so the record contains both the physician's impression diagnostically, and also in the chart is incorporated all of the concerns that the parents have. I can't remember if he specifically said, if he examined the lymph nodes and diagnosed them with lymphadenopathy.
How do you reconcile your testimony today regarding measles virus with the testimony of the virologist, Dr. Griffin, in the Cedillo case?
I don't recall specifically what you said about viruses and the persistence of virus. Can you refresh my mind as to what particular aspect of a report?
You have no recollection of that.
Well, I read a report. I remember, in the Cedillo, I'm sorry, I was thinking of a respondent to this case. I don't remember. I looked at some of these kind of a while ago. But can you maybe point out a particular statement she made that I could discuss?
It was a very long testimony that I don't want to go through.
Okay.
And so, any of the experts that testified in the Cedillo case, you're not familiar enough with their testimony to know whether your testimony conflicts or confirms any of the testimony the experts in the CDOK.
Well, I've looked at some of the several of the reports a while ago, and some of them I know of from previous writings, so I kind of know the way people think, and I read the respondents, the virologist to my report for the immunologist.
Are you familiar with the testimony given by Dr. Ward, Dr. Buston, Dr. Fujinami's report, and Dr. Chadwick regarding the reliability of the works of Dr. Allman, Kawashima, Walker, and Dr. Wakefield?
A little bit more Dr. Buston than the rest.
And how do you reconcile your testimony then with the testimony of Dr. Buston?
My testimony, first of all, I think there were some questions about methodology with PCR and the reliability of some labs, such as Eugenics with Dr. O'Leary in Ireland. My assessment is made with some more recent reports with Dr. Stephen Walker's lab and Dr. Heppner, who have reviewed not just the Dr. Allman's work, but have reviewed some of the criticisms that have been made. And what I got out of that is that some of the labs that have tried to replicate some of the earlier studies, for example, from Dr. Allman's lab, did not quite match up if you look at the methodology. For example, there's one lab that tried to look at measles virus in a group of children that did not even have gastrointestinal problems. Also, I think one of the labs looked at kids that had gastrointestinal problems, but looked at blood samples instead of tissue samples from the gut. I also looked at Dr. Hepburn's, the way she characterized the methodology of Dr. Allman, all of the controls that were used to make sure that there was no cross-contamination, to make sure that repeating techniques or repetitive techniques, different techniques were used to arrive at the same conclusion. And I felt very comfortable. I'm not a molecular biologist, but based on my reading, based on the fact that she looked at it, Dr. Walker looked at it in a separate way, that they felt comfortable upholding Dr. Allman's work and the validity of his conclusion. So I, for me, reading that type of literature, I'm comfortable with that as opposed to what Dr. Buston would say about the reliability of those things.
Have you ever done PCR?
I've ordered it several times, but do you mean did I work as a technologist doing
yes.
PCR? No, I'm not a technologist, I'm a physician.
You referred to Dr. Walker?
Yes.
Does Dr. Walker published, what reports by Dr. Walker are you referring to?
I'm referring to a poster presentation that was done, I think, about a year ago, and the findings of which were mentioned by Dr. Her name is Hepburn in the CDO case.
Has Dr. Walker published the results that were on that poster board?
Has he published it yet? I don't know that he's already published it. I think I believe he's doing some other aspects of the study. I haven't seen the published results yet, so I would assume, just an assumption, that it's not yet published.
Is the study complete? Do you know that?
I don't know that it's completed either.
So you're basing your assertions of Dr. Walker's report on a poster board of a study that has not yet been published that you don't know the results of because it's not yet complete.
I have reviewed Dr. Hepburn's study, and I'm very comfortable with her. First of all, I believe she's an expert based on her credentials and based on her assessment. I've actually read through, again, I'm not a molecular biologist, but I've read through carefully the arguments that she made, not only for Dr. Allman's study, but I looked at what some of the other labs did, and I feel very comfortable, at least with the information that I have present, that Allman's study could be upheld scientifically.
Have you ever done any scientific studies on Thimerosal yourself?
I'm a clinician, I'm not a researcher.
So you've never published any articles on Thimerosal?
No.
Have you ever published any articles on MMR?
No.
Have you ever published a peer review article on autism? No. Have you ever published?
I'm sorry. Did you get an audible answer to that last
yes. question? No, I have not published a peer reviewed article on autism.
Have you published a peer review article on any subject relating to autism or developmental disorders?
I've written a couple of books, but I have not, as a clinician, I have not chosen the path at this time, or at least early in my career, to get into the field of research with publication. I did mention earlier that I was invited to join the medical staff in Cincinnati to do pediatric stroke, which would have been a path that would have led to a lot of publications by this time, but I am a clinician, so I have not had the time to publish in peer review in that sense.
What are the books that you have published?
All of them are the ones pertaining to autism.
The ones pertaining to autism.
Okay. The first one was Solving the Enigma of Autism, and the second one is Optimal Treatment for Children with Autism and Other Neuropsychiatric Illnesses. The last one I mentioned is the second book that was published in 2005, I think, and the other one was published earlier.
And this is, I have Solving the Enigma of Autism, this is one of your
yes,
books.
Yes, that's the first book.
Did you pay to have that book published?
Are you inferring, was this a self-published
yes.
book? Yes, it was a self-published book, but then all five of my books have been self-published.
Were they peer-reviewed by any other pediatric neurologists?
I have shared that particular book with other neurologists to kind of get their thoughts. But when you say peer-reviewed in terms of, did they accept what I wrote? Or I got comments from other professionals, yes, after it was published.
How many patients have you ever treated with SSPE?
I have not treated any patients with SSPE. SSPE, I must say, is extremely rare at this time, so I've not treated anyone with SSPE that I could recall.
Have you ever treated someone with measles inclusion body encephalitis?
No.
What kind of virus is measles virus?
I think it's a paramyxovirus.
Paramyxovirus?
I believe so.
What is a paramyxovirus?
It's a specific type of virus that is very virulent and can cause a lot of immunosuppressive symptoms. That's what I can tell you on that type of virus.
I have no further questions.
Mr. Webb?
I don't have any further questions.
I do. And I have to say we're probably at the limit. Maybe nobody else had as much talking to me as I have. I'll try and move through this very quickly. Dr. Corbier, you are a clinician in your current patients about the age of 3 to 4 years old now, recently been diagnosed with autism. When did you find that the profile that you described creates?
There are some, but since I moved to North Carolina, a lot of the patients that I see are quite a bit older, and a lot of the patients that I've seen recently have had problems, not so much of the regular types, a lot of the problems. I have to say that I've seen less patients with autism here than I did in Montgomery, so the ratio is less.
So you're seeing fewer autism patients?
In general, yes, right now.
The ones that you're seeing who are older, have they followed you generally from your practice in Alabama?
I've had several patients that have come from Alabama to North Carolina to see me, and I've had some individuals from out of state. I think Yason is an example. Even when I was in Alabama, they drove from Tennessee to see me, and I'm still following them. The last visit was in July. Does that answer
it? It does. Have my questions triggered any further questions by counsel?
No.
I don't have any.
Okay. I thank you all. I think we are scheduled to resume tomorrow with the testimony of
Thank you.